Mysterious drone sightings are making headlines not only in New Jersey and the Northeast, but all over the nation this week. What are they and who's behind them? New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith is here with an update. She's a professed nun, a medical doctor, and a retired colonel in the U.S. Army. She's also the subject of a new book telling her life story. Sister, soldier, surgeon, Sister Dee Dee Byrne, and the author of the book are here to tell us all about it. And with Christmas just around the corner, we'll bring you the origin stories of some of the most beloved songs of the season and a behind-the-scenes glimpse at my album, Christmas Merry and Bright. We're going to keep it merry and bright. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We have a good show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo, at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Don't settle for the fakes. Christmas is nearly here. Let's get to it. As part of this year's Cribs at the Vatican exhibition, the controversial artist Simone Legno, responsible for the widely panned Jubilee Year 2025 mascot, Luce, has created his own nativity. Legno's exhibit features Mary, Joseph, and Jesus in a manger of pink hay with huge eyes. The artist's company has previously endorsed LGBT pride, selling pride-themed merch on their website. Why does all his work look like escapees from the Luce universe? Archbishop Rino Fisichella, who's the prefect of the Dicastery for Evangelization, is responsible for both the exhibition and the 2025 Jubilee Year. We will pray he gets better taste in that new year. And the rash of drone sightings that began over parts of New Jersey over a month ago has now spread across the country, with sightings reported in Ohio, Utah, California, Texas. But so far, the government has furnished no concrete answers to the American people about the nature or the origin of these objects, and there doesn't seem to be any urgency. Tonight with me is someone who has been demanding answers, and he's going to weigh in on these odd sightings. Please welcome back to the program U.S. Congressman from New Jersey, senior member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, Chris Smith.
Thank you so much for having me, as always.
Delighted always to have you on
the
program.
Love your show.
Congressman, look. On December 12th, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI jointly released a statement. Here's what they said. We have no evidence at this time that the reported drone sightings pose a national security or public safety threat or have a foreign nexus. Congressman, that was a week ago. And now we're hearing that the FAA is banning drone flights near what they're calling critical infrastructure in New Jersey until January 17th. What is this about?
22 sites, and they coincide with PSE&G, which is the electrical company. Apparently, they asked for it, and they're right over, you know, large electrical substations and the like. And, you know, they say it's out of an abundance of caution. You don't do that. You don't ban it, make it no fly if it's not more than that. So there's been this downgrading of concern. I mean, when Secretary Mayorkas said there's nothing unusual here, and John Kirby, has just time and time again provided, in my humble opinion, disinformation about what is actually going on.
Yeah.
Stop it. We want the truth. We want transparency.
Yeah, John Kirby, who's the White House spokesman, national security advisor, he was asked about the drone activity. He said it's all lawful and legal, okay? But you've spoken to the Coast Guard since then, and you know he indicated that the Coast Guard may have mistaken these drones for aircraft flying over JFK.
Right.
You spoke with a commander at the Coast Guard. He told you what?
Well, he told me absolutely one of his 47-foot rescue boats had drones following off the stern 100 feet. That's close. That's three first downs on a football field. And, you know, the Coast Guard personnel are very smart, situationally aware. They have to be for the tasks that they undertake. And they know what they saw. And then he goes and says, and this is in Ocean County, pretty far away from JFK, yeah, that these were jets going into John F. Kennedy. That is absurd. You know, and they're doubling down. I just talked to a Homeland Security representative who said, we've looked at this. And it's, what have you looked at? Have you talked to the commanding officer who told me this and the crew on that on that vessel? Don't lie to us. Be honest. Be transparent. Sometimes you can't tell us, you know, the public, everything because of secrecy purposes. But there's been a full month of this, and we're still dealing with, look at that.
Yeah, ignore it. You're not seeing anything.
You're not seeing anything.
It's all legal. Don't worry about it. On December 16th, Congressman, President-elect Trump was asked about these drone sightings at a press conference at Mar-a-Lago. Here's what he said.
The government knows what is happening. Look, our military knows where they took off from. If it's a garage, they can go right into that garage. They know where it came from and where it went. And for some reason, they don't want to comment.
Have you received an intelligence briefing on the drones?
I don't want to comment on that.
Okay, Congressman, there was a briefing for the Intel Committee at the House.
Yeah.
You heard what Trump said there, that the government knows. Have you been furnished with sufficient answers?
No, not at all. And nor has most members. And I would suggest, because I've been on secret meetings myself, a part of, not that one, that you don't always get everything. They hold back for whatever reason, because there's a lot of leaking that goes on. But frankly, we don't know where they came from, who, what's the origination. I asked Secretary Mayorkas in a meeting that we had online, and I said, why don't we just follow one of them or shoot one of them
shoot
down?
Shoot them down, yeah.
You know, they're unmanned and do it in a way that does not put people on the ground at risk and decipher who it is. It could be China, it could be Russia, it could be Iran, it could be a lot of other, it could be a terrorist state, but they're so sophisticated that it suggests a superpower like China or Russia, and they are so advanced in their drone technology, and we can't follow them.
And what did Mayorkas say?
He just says we can't follow them. He was clueless. He was deer in the headlights.
So what do you think it is? Level with us. What do you, at this point,
I think,
you've talked to so many players here, on the front lines of this. What is this? Is it, look, I've been told by people, I'll just be candid here, that it's military aircraft.
Well, I've asked that question at the very top, and they have told me this has nothing to do with DOD or any of our assets, CIA, you name it. It's not U.S. So if it's not U.S., who is it? I mean, Putin has been using drones in warfare, and so is Ukraine. China has perfected, the art of war, wrong word, but it is a terrible, horrible art.
Well, they flew balloons all over the United States.
We did nothing.
Reconnaissance.
We did nothing. And they went over our various bases.
Right.
Is this a continuation
of that?
I think a reasonable man or woman can speculate that China could be behind this. We don't know it, absolutely. Mm. But if they do know it, they should tell us. And they have not told us. And why not get one of the drones and find out?
Right. Just shoot it down and figure it out. Yeah,
exactly.
This is not hard. It does. They do travel over water.
They do.
Or they're over air.
Like the ones I'm talking about here.
They shut down whole runways at LaGuardia.
I know.
Shoot it down over
They've been over. I have a naval weapons station, Earl, in my district.
Yeah.
It's where the Navy gets a lot of its munitions. Yeah. There's a long track. It goes out to the pier. Ships come in, and they are loaded with munitions. Yeah. They've been spotted over Earl. And to me, at that point you say enough is enough. We're gonna bring one of these down and find out, is it China or Russia or some other country?
The fact that President Trump canceled his weekend plans to Bedminster in New Jersey, where these drones were also flying over, tells you almost everything.
And I love the way he did it. He did it with tongue in cheek, but he knows he could be at risk.
Right. Right. And we should all be concerned about
that.
I want to move on quickly. President-elect Trump and VP-elect Vance interjected themselves into this debate over federal spending just days before the government could shut down. There is a continuing resolution funding of a bill that could sail through Congress, but it stalled. And this is going to fund everything from now till March. Vance and Trump are saying, don't do this. It's going to raise the debt ceiling. We've got to cut programs. Your take on this. Where are we now? And do you think there's time to look at options here?
I think we're likely going to have a so-called clean which means just change the dates so that the government, as it's operating now, continues to sometime in early March. And frankly, that would give the president the opportunity to really create a budget to get us working on a Trump budget for fiscal year 2025. And I think that's, I mean, normally all of this should have been done by the end of September. That's when our fiscal year ends. But it's been
delayed.
But
don't we play this game
every
year? It's always Christmas Eve, Christmas Day.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. We're maxing out your credit cards.
Yeah, right.
Good luck. I want to talk for a moment. You recently voiced concern over reports of U.S. involvement in a pro-abortion bill in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
The Biden administration is threatening to withhold foreign assistance to Sierra Leone unless legislators there pass a deceptively named Safe Motherhood Act legislation. It would legalize abortion in the country, a country that currently protects unborn life. What's happening there, and what measures can you or anybody else take to stop what amounts to coercion on the part of the Biden administration?
You know, Raymond, this is why I held up final passage of a five-year reauthorization of the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief.
Right.
Because Biden had hijacked the AIDS program, which was doing good things under George W. Bush, hijacked it and said, right in his guidance, change the laws in these countries as it relates to abortion. In other words, liberalize abortion.
Yep.
The people that we support, the funding that we give, and we're talking, in that case, $6.8 billion per year. That is a critical mass of funding where a African country, for example, or others that are PEPFAR recipients would find themselves under enormous pressure. So we've been fighting against that. Now there's a thing called the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which has a mandate to try to do good governance, and they give out money to countries like Sierra Leone. Well, we have a very credible sources suggesting that they're trying to link passage of that bill with over $400 million that the Biden administration has agreed to give them. I'm saying foul. You can't do that. And I'm ordering and asking for it, and I think we'll get it, an inspector general's report about whether or not Sierra Leone is the only country. There may be others because they do things, again, non-transparently. Yeah. And how dare we coerce, perfect word, say you need this money, you need it badly for humanitarian reasons, and we're going to now link it with killing your babies on demand under the false statement of safe motherhood.
Yeah.
I've read the bill from cover to cover. It's all about abortion for any reason whatsoever, socioeconomic, mental. And I did talk to the speaker of Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
He's very pro-life. And I do have every confidence that they're going to resist this pressure. But how dare the Biden administration again weaponize every federal program, foreign and domestic, to promote the chemical poisoning of, the dismemberment of unborn children by way of abortion. And that's what they've done, from the VA here to DOD to everywhere else. And now our foreign aid is being linked. You know, if you're going to do foreign aid, do it out of pure altruistic, humanitarian reasons. Don't you dare push an agenda that includes abortion on demand.
Congressman Smith, you and I know, because I remember covering this with you. Gosh, it's got to be 25 years ago, maybe longer now, when the Clinton administration was holding foreign aid hostage to abortion legislation in foreign countries.
They were doing it. And as a matter of fact, Hillary Clinton
changed.
Had an outsized role in that.
Right.
Then during Obama for 8 years, we had to fight that every single day. And I'm not exaggerating, because they tell these people, you want your foreign aid? Well, if you want foreign aid from the United States of America, you better liberalize abortion. And you know, who loses? The mothers? The babies and families.
Congressman Chris Smith, we will leave it there. We'll check in with you in the new year.
Raymond,
thank you. Have a wonderful Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Raymond.
Well, I don't have to tell you, Christmas is my favorite time of the year, especially the music of Christmas. It always puts me in the mood. And I have to tell you, I loved discovering the origins of so many of these songs that we take for granted. When I went into the studio to record my Christmas album, Christmas Merry and Bright, I did a deep dive into these carols and hymns that we've heard our whole lives. And when you discover the backstory, it changes the meaning of all of these songs, or at least the intent. It gives it a deeper resonance. Here's a bit of the backstory and origins of these beloved classics and a behind-the-scenes look at the recording of Christmas Merry and Bright. Watch.
One, two, one, two, three. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king.
I've always loved Christmas music. This is my favorite time of the year. It's my favorite music ever, and full confession, I listen to Christmas music year-round.
Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king.
Here's what I love most about Christmas music. It's eternal. It touches the past, the present, and the future. Your great-grandparents were singing many of these songs. We're singing these songs today, and our children's children will be singing them tomorrow. So there's something timeless about these particular songs, what they mean, the memories they evoke, and I think most importantly, the feelings that well up within us whenever we hear them.
Joy to the world, the Savior reigns. Let men their songs implore.
My audience mostly knows me from television or my books. What they probably don't know is in my early life, I was trained as an actor, I did a lot of musicals, and I sang. And then for many years I didn't. So when I was approached to do this project, I kind of backed off for a minute. I was a little hesitant. But after looking at the repertoire and thinking, what could I do unique here? What could I offer to these songs and to the audience? I thought, okay, let's go on this adventure. I loved it. It was like getting in touch with a part of myself that I guess I had left behind or thought I'd left behind. It's never too late. As anybody who's followed my literary career or read any of my books knows, there's a theme that runs through all of them, which is this. I take something you think you know, and I show you a different angle on it. That lights it up in a whole new way. So I went through each of these tunes, and I basically did a deep dive into each of them. Where did they come from? What do they mean? And I have to tell you, I was stunned by some of what I discovered. Jingle Bells was one of those discoveries.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey.
It was written by a guy named James Lord Pierpont, who was actually the uncle of J.P. Morgan. And Pierpont was, well, how do I put this lightly? A bit of a womanizer, we think. He wrote this song, which was originally titled One Horse Open Sleigh. He wrote it in a tavern in Medford, Massachusetts. Now, Medford was a town at the time known for rum and drag racing sleighs in the snow down the main street.
A day or two ago, I thought I'd take a ride, and soon Miss Fanny Bright was seated by my side.
This song is really about drag racing with a side of rum and girls in the snow. We cast the song in that way.
Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
So when you hear it, it's propulsive, it's a little crazed at times, but the jingle bells, when you're in the one-horse open sleigh with a girl, you got to ring bells to let people know you're coming because it's dark out. Jingle Bells takes on a slightly different character when you see it that way. So we had to do it in that historical setting.
You want another ride?
That's it.
To me, Christmas has a classic sound. So when we were thinking, how should we approach this album? I knew I wanted a big band feel and sound. Kevin Koska was our arranger on this project. And Kevin, if you don't know his name, you certainly know his work.
Kevin Costner arranged and orchestrated The Greatest Showman, The Dark Knight, The Live Jungle Book, The Live Lion King. But his background and his love is jazz. We brought these songs to him, and in record time, he turned out some incredible, sizzling hot at times, and very tender, beautiful arrangements.
I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play.
I Heard the Bells is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's a three-act play that touches on the dark side of Christmas. Not everybody has a happy, joyous Christmas. Some people are plagued with depression and sadness during Christmas, and I wanted to speak to that in the album. And though it's called Merry and Bright, the song gets merry and bright. It finds hope on the other side of tragedy.
Peace on earth, goodwill to men.
It was written by Longfellow, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the great American poet. He had lost his wife in a fire. She caught fire in their house. He tried to put out the flames. She died, but he burned his face and his body terribly trying to put her out. The year this song happens, his son runs off to the Civil War without telling him, comes back home on a stretcher the day before Christmas, paralyzed from a bullet that went through one shoulder and out the other and hit his spine. So Wadsworth is sitting in his office, and he hears down the block bells of the church, and he is depressed and very miserable and in despair.
And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said. For hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men.
Then there's a bridge. He listens to the bells, and suddenly hope falls upon him. And he says, then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep.
The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men.
We've added a verse here at the end that I took from the original poem. It was not part of the song, but it felt right to add that as a fourth verse because it's about us and how, if you listen closely, you can still hear those bells and find that hope. I love that about this song.
Open your heart and hear your part of peace on earth, goodwill to men.
In the heart of the French Quarter, there's a wonderful little theater in New Orleans, Le Petit Theater. Sound-wise, it was perfect, and it fit all of us.
Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills, and everywhere. Go,
this go, band, these are like the super players of New Orleans. Many of these guys have been playing together for 30, 40 years. They know each other so well and gelled so quickly. I've really never seen anything like it.
Most of the cats in the band have a lot of history of working together over the past decades. So when this collection of musicians come together, it's instantaneous connection, and the music just flows because we not only know each other musically, but we know each other personally.
The music itself is expressive. A lot of the songs have a lot of depth to them, a lot of history behind them, and a lot of stories within them. So I really think the way they're arranged really helps to bring those stories to life. And then that coupled with the band, I mean, it feels really good.
We made a decision early on, as much as we could, that we would record live with the band in the room. Now, that is often not the case today. Usually, they lay down the tracks with the band, and the singer is in an isolation booth weeks later recording to tracks. I didn't want to do that. That feeling that you get, there is a rich crackle in the room. You can hear it on those recordings.
That style of music has a certain energy to it. It's very soulful, swinging. There are great big bands all around the world, but big bands in New Orleans have a different thing, so I enjoy that.
We need to capture the energy and the spirit and the goosebumps that the listener gets while listening to this type of music. Raymond has been fun. He knows exactly what he wants. He has very high standards for himself, which is really all we can ask for.
He wants to get it right. You know, all of us want to get it right, and he's right in there with it, which is killing. It's really good.
His musical instincts are phenomenal. He's just a character. He's fun. You know, he makes it fun for everybody.
You know, when he walked in the room, he has this bigger-than-life charisma that just kind of takes over the room.
He's a great singer. Really, really nice guy. He's just, is he a comedian? Because, I mean, he cracks me up.
We told it.
What I love about this medley, which is the First Noel and We Magi of Orient Are. Now, people look at that and they go, now, Raymond Arroyo, why are you doing a medley of the First Noel, which came from Miracle Plays? Miracle Plays were plays staged, again, straining at the mystery of the Nativity. These things go back to the 3rd and 4th century. That's where the First Noel originated. And Noel is news. So it's the first news, the first good news.
Noel, 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 Noel. Born is the King of Israel.
I love that the First Noel and the song previously known as We Three Kings all reference a bright light, a great light that drew the shepherds and then the wise men to the Christ child.
And to the earth it gave a great light, and so it continued both day and night.
What we did here is I changed the lyrics of We Three Kings to We Magi of Orient Are. Now, why might I do that? The Gospels don't reference kings. There were no kings. They were wise men. They were magi.
We magi of Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse afar.
It is a driving, exciting journey for these wise men. And I love that the arrangement captures the joy and the fascination and the awesome, incredible explosion of light that these men are drawn to. And I think all these songs are reaching for that mystery, reaching for that indescribable moment when God becomes man. And every generation contributes something new to that mysterious yearning to understand what happened 2,000 years ago in Bethlehem. Boy, did the NOLA players do an incredible job on this. It is an incredible musical moment.
Happy New Year, good tidings to you.
Oh, wait, no. What was I thinking?
What I could do is, I just do the top of this as me. We wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I start here and we bring the trio treatment thing in here. Good tidings to you wherever you are. We could do that. Now that's something we could do.
There are certain voices of Christmas that I have always loved. Some I was honored to meet, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could somehow honor them on this album? So,
we decided to do We Wish You a Merry Christmas as sort of a caroling squad of very familiar voices, some of whom I hope you recognize. Here's my little tribute, my little merry and bright Christmas gift to you.
So one, two, three.
There's some voices of Christmas that I've always loved. Nat King Cole, Bing Crosby, Dean Martin, and Frank Sinatra. And I'd like to honor them with a song. So, Kevin arranged really five different songs within one.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
We Wish You a Merry Christmas is one of those songs people think, oh, this is just a ditty. Well, it has a great historic root. In England, from 1647 to 1660, Oliver Cromwell outlawed the singing of carols and Christmas carols in England. Following that, carolers used to go door to door. People who were churchgoers, the poor ones, would go to the doors of the rich people who also believed, and they would sing these Christmas carols to keep the traditional carols alive. We Wish You a Merry Christmas is one of those songs. It's part of the Christmas celebration, part of the communal cheer of Christmas.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
This was my way of honoring these great singers who kept beautiful music of the season alive. And to be a part of that now myself, it's incredible. Did you like?
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. We'll cut the next album. Oh, there you go. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw it, you would think he was a tattoos. Rudy, your red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history. Go, go, go. We have our next album.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright.
Mike Esnault was not only our conductor, he's our pianist. And there is one track on this album we didn't intend to do, and that is Silent Night. I've always loved this song. It's a tender prayer, really, to me. And I thought, why don't we just do it, just you and me, Mike backing me on the piano, and I did the vocals. It's the only track on the album that's just piano and vocals.
Sleep in heavenly peace.
It's so tender, you don't want to disturb it. It's sleep in heavenly peace. You don't do that with trumpets.
Christ the Savior is born.
Oh, he's here. Jose, you made it. How you doing?
Good.
When I knew I was doing a Christmas album, Merry and Bright, one of the first people who popped into mind was Jose Feliciano.
Feliz Navidad.
Oye, Feliz Navidad. Oye,
Feliz Navidad.
Jose is an international voice of Christmas, and his Feliz Navidad is one of the most downloaded songs of the season. People love it. Not only did he agree to come and be a guest on the album, Jose agreed to do a new arrangement.
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
this was a song that I wrote to venerate the Savior. Mm. And that was the most important thing to me on that.
And part of it was commemorating being in Puerto Rico as a kid, right?
Yeah.
During Christmas.
Being there with my folks and enjoying the rum, the pasteles. You call them tamales.
Yes, we do. What I love about our version of Feliz Navidad is it brings in a bit of that memory of Puerto Rico and your childhood, and then just puts a fresh spin on a classic. Jose did an incredible flamenco solo that I just loved. To sit across in a recording studio from a legend like Jose Feliciano for me was just, what an honor. I think people will love it. I dare you not to sing along. I love the togetherness of Christmas, the warmth of Christmas, the memories of Christmas. And I wanted to capture all of that in this album.
Singing carols, stringing popcorn, making footprints in the snow.
There is a particular song that I do on the album, Christmas Memories, which is rarely recorded. It was written by Don Costa. Don Costa was Frank Sinatra's orchestrator and producer. Costa only wrote 11 songs. One of them was Christmas Memories. And Alan and Marilyn Bergman wrote such tender and sweet lyrics for this song. So we did Christmas Memories in our own way.
Cookies baking in the kitchen, cards and ribbons everywhere.
It remains a favorite because every time I hear the bridge of the song, I weep. There's a lyric that goes in the middle of the song. We had a way of making Christmas morning as merry as can be. I close my eyes and see shining faces of all the children who now have children of their own. And whenever I hear that lyric, this happens.
We had a way of making Christmas morning as merry as can be. I close my eyes and see shiny faces of all the children who now have children of their own.
Because I'm moving to that place where I see my own children getting married, about to have their own families. My parents have gone through this already. And it is wonderful and beautiful at Christmas to see you go on, your family goes on, and you gather around these traditions you so love. And that's what Christmas is all about. So it's one of my favorite tunes ever.
And oh, the joy of waking Christmas morning, the family around the tree.
I do it with my daughter. My daughter sang in the bridge with me. And it only deepens, I think, the joy and the drama of the song. And it's so beautiful. It's a neglected classic.
Very sweet. Nice.
I can only describe this project as an explosion of joy.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly.
We wanted to remind people of the cheerful, wonderful, joyous, bright parts of the Christmas season at a time in the world when, frankly, we focus on division and differences and hatred. I thought it important for us to take a breath at Christmas and remember the joyous and the merry and the bright.
La 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 la.
It's my little contribution to the music and wonder of Christmas. La, la, la,
la. You can get your copy of Christmas Merry and Bright, my debut Christmas album, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple Music, Spotify, and the EWTN catalog. Wherever you get your music, it's there.
She's a physician, retired Army colonel, superior of the Little Workers of the Sacred Heart, and a tireless defender of life. She's also the subject of a brand new book, Sister, Soldier, Surgeon, The Life and Courage of Sister Deirdre Byrne. Please welcome to the program Sister Deirdre Byrne and Dr. Lisa Marie Corazon. Thank you both for being here. Sister Deedee, I want to thank you first. And this book really begins in your childhood and growing up in a large family. Your father was a physician. Your mom's a homemaker. You have seven siblings, including your brother Bill, who's now the Bishop of Springfield. Mm-hmm. What were the lessons you learned growing up in that household? And how did they shape your receptiveness to the multiple callings that lay ahead for you?
Well, I think, first of all, my parents were wonderful leaders. My father was the spiritual guide. I think that's really important. So the family is a home of vocations. I had five brothers and I have two sisters, and we just, you learn how to stand in line to wait for the bathroom and things like that. So I think bigger is best for families, I think.
Mm. Tell me, how did it mark your personality? I mean, obviously, in big families, you learn cooperation. You learn, as you said, to wait your turn. Did it mark you in any other ways?
I don't know. I think I was born with a dislocated hip. My mother diagnosed the condition. And I remember I had a body cast for a year and a half, and my older siblings would drag me across the floor, step on me to get something high on a shelf. And I always joke around and say that, you know, I said, I learned that sometimes being stepped on is really just lifting your others up. So you learn to give and take and to not be the center of attention. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't watch TV that much. We had each other, and we were all big in sports. We weren't big in academics, so we were all really good in some sport event. And I don't know, I guess like many families, but the most important, I would say, is that both my mother and father were daily mass goers. They went to mass every day. My father was a thoracic surgeon, but he went to the 6:45 mass every day. He wouldn't miss mass. He would crawl on all fours before he'd, you know, miss communion. And my mom would, when we were all at school, she'd go to the 9 o'clock here in McLean, Virginia.
Uh-huh. Let's talk for a moment about your multiple vocations. I mean, you attend Georgetown Medical School, as the book says, first. Then you join the U.S. Army while you're still in med school to help pay for the education. How did becoming a doctor lead to your religious vocation?
Well, quite honestly, I think my religious vocation came first, and that was in utero. When, my mother always said my vocation started in utero. So I was always drawn to religious sisters, drawn to missionary work. My father was close friends with and studied with Sister Frederick Needfield, who was a medical mission sister. I met her when I was in high school. I also learned about Mother Teresa of Calcutta during that time. And what she did really resonated with me. It was something that I wanted to do when I grew up. I haven't grown up yet, but something I wanted to do. And so that was really important. So vocation first, nurturing it. My father was a doctor. I have a couple siblings that are doctors. And so I just followed in that realm. And then I heard there was a scholarship program with the Army, and it sounded great because my dad at that time had five of us either in college or grad school. So it was really something that would help us. And although he said, you know, I've saved the money, but I said I wanted to do something that could help them in that regard, and I never regretted it. It was bittersweet, but it was a So that was as a first-year med student, and that's a health professional scholarship program. It's still going on today.
Sister, in late 2001, you received news that really redirected your religious life. Cardinal Hickey, the longtime Archbishop of Washington, D.C., resigned, and his successor was Theodore McCarrick. Now, Hickey had intended to give you an old convent, but there was a hitch. What happened there, and where did trust in God's will take you?
Well, I always say, Hickey gaveth, McCarrick tooketh away.
He did that for a lot of people.
You know, during that time, I was at the point now. I'd finished my certification surgery. I was a board-certified family medicine surgery, basically ready for the Lord to use me in any way He wanted to. And I had emptied myself, basically, of all my free will and design. So anything that happened was, to me, not surprising, and I was okay with it. And it was during that time, too, that I met the Little Workers of the Sacred Hearts. Father Robert Falabella, who just recently died, was the guide that brought me and introduced me to my now superior, Sister Licia, who's now gone to heaven. And with emptying myself to my own will, the Lord could then fill me with what He wanted. And it was very beautiful in one way. So because Cardinal Hickey gave me a convent, he was even willing to follow me with, you know, to guide me. He was my guide. And I remember Sister Priscilla, our Mother Teresa's Secretary General, she and I were friends. She said, I've never seen a cardinal be so receptive to anyone. This must be God's will. But then when McCarrick took it away, it was more of God's seeing how much of a faithful steward I would be for him, I think.
Mm. Well, sometimes you have to be tried. You know, he tests those vocations and, you know, and your trust in him, which is, you know, the way I read it when I was reading the story.
Right.
Sister, over the years you ministered at Ground Zero on September 11th. You, as you mentioned a moment ago, you served St. Mother Teresa's. You were her personal physician. And you deployed as a surgeon to Afghanistan for Operation Enduring Freedom.
Yeah.
Give me a sense. I mean, you still travel regularly to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan to give medical aid to the victims of the war there. Throughout all of this, you continue to evangelize. How does God speak to you and direct you to as to where to go and what to do, what to spend your time doing?
I've learned in my many, many years of life now to understand that internal stirring in my own heart. Our community spends a lot of time in prayer. We, in our little house here in D.C., we have adoration two or three times a day. And I couldn't do anything without the Eucharist and adoration. And our founder said it's before the Most Blessed Sacrament that I found the love of Jesus and the power of that love. And that's really held true for me through my life. And so I think you just have to trust that hunch that's within your heart to be able to speak out, speak strongly, and know that, you know, you're here for Him, not for anyone else. So to not be afraid, as John Paul II said, be not afraid.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, how did you come to know Sister Dee Dee, and what inspired you to want to put pen to paper and capture her story now?
Thank you, Raymond. I first met Sister, like most folks, after the 2020 RNC, and I was so excited to see somebody in habit raise her rosary for the whole nation to see and proclaim that she was not just pro-life, but pro-eternal life. I literally cheered in my living room, as did many people of faith. I called her cold, and I just expressed my gratitude for the exemplary courage that this woman showed. I was so excited. I asked for permission to meet her, and when I went to ask for permission to write the book, her response was, "You must be writing a comic book." And then she begged me, could I please wait until she's dead? I assured her, Sister, we can't wait until you're dead. Our children and grandchildren need you now more than ever. We need her to be our voice.
Sister Dee Dee, I know you fairly well. Give me a sense of what your reaction was when you heard this. I mean, I remember when I went to Mother Angelica and asked her if I could write her biography, she was a little cold to it at first and then said, okay, let me pray about it. Let's start and see what happens. That's what she said. But I think she almost said that to try to get me to go away. what did you think when Lisa came to you with this idea?
You know, I was trying my best to discourage her. But nothing would discourage her. I mean, every time we got one bad news, you know, because President Trump had endorsed the book, God bless him, a lot of people were running away. And she persevered. She cut out a couple chapters and threw in new chapters. And so I really admire that, but I wish it wasn't me. I wish I wasn't the topic. But if it's going to be for the glory of God and for... You know, maybe vocations, young ladies will see that you can be not only a religious sister, but you can do things through with the gifts that God has given you. So, and I get to talk to you, Raymond, which is wonderful.
Well, that's right. See, another fringe benefit, but you could talk to me before there was a book, and I'm sure you'll talk to me after. So, though, look, you've been no stranger to public scrutiny, despite your desire to avoid it. When the COVID pandemic began, there was great uncertainty. There were curfews and church closures. And in August of 2020, as Lisa mentioned, you spoke at the RNC, striking a chord with millions of people. You said, I'm not just pro-life, but pro-eternal life. And your words galvanized the pro-life movement at that time. In the book, Dr. Corazon writes, she calls it your Esther moment. And you took a lot of heat for speaking and supporting President Trump at the time. Your thoughts on the recent election that we saw? This historic second term secured by President-elect Trump and his pro-life record compared to the alternative?
Well, I'm grateful to God that he was elected, because I don't know what would happen to our country if he wasn't in the held. And I think J.D. Vance is wonderful, too. They're going to make a great dynamic duo. I do pray that I can have an opportunity to talk to him about the RU-486 and the in vitro fertilization issue. But he's very strong in the life is not only just the unborn, but it's you know, the dignity of a human person, young children, you know, the fighting of the issue of men being in female sports, the transgender issue in the military, which I think has ruin the military, and we need to get back to where we were. So, you know, our dear President Trump is going to correct all those things. The Mexico law, where our tax money is going to pay for contraception, things like that, he's going to undo all that. And I pray that he's going to help get a lot of these unfair, these young J6ers who are thrown in prison that are still there, for our pro-lifers, Joan Bell, you know, Will Goodman, many who have been in prison for a year and a half. Praying at an abortion clinic, a third trimester abortion clinic in D.C., where he's still killing babies in the third trimester. So he's going to do a lot of wonderful things. So I just hope that if he's listening to this, that he lets me have 5 minutes with him on the abortion pill, because we have reversed, we're 88% successful in our little convent of bringing life, helping to our little babies from being aborted from the abortion pill to surviving. It's very successful.
Sister Dee Dee, you've ministered to hundreds and hundreds, thousands probably of people. But during the COVID pandemic, you used a medicinal protocol that was very effective. You kept people out of the hospital, prevented further injuries, saved lives. But these were strategies that were shunned by the mainstream medical establishment. You eventually took the D.C. government to court, and you won an exemption from the vaccine mandate. What did that experience teach you, sister? Did it teach you anything?
Well, no. I'm always learning. First of all, shout out to the Thomas More lawyers and Chris Farrar for helping me win that case, and you and Laura Ingraham bringing it out to the open. I just learned that we shouldn't be afraid when it comes to truth, speaking the truth with love. You know, I felt that vaccine was something was not good for me, in the sense that I didn't want to take something that was either tested by or made by aborted fetal tissue. That was one thing. I was very careful. If I was near someone who was elderly or sick, I treated my mother, who's now 101, and Sister Alicia, who was 89 at the time, and we successfully treated everyone, elderly, hundreds and hundreds of people with this therapy. So I learned to trust in God. Each step, it's always a greater level of trust, and to know that with truth and love, we can fight and stand strong. As a result of winning, all the healthcare practitioners in Washington, D.C. had their religious exemption accepted. And I would walk in the hospital and people would come up to me that I didn't even know, thanking me for fighting. Because I guess I was the tip of the arrow of that fight, and they thought if I went down, the rest can go down. But, I didn't have anything to lose.
You prevailed.
Yeah, I prevailed. I didn't have anything to lose. I didn't have anything to lose, really, to fight this issue. I don't have a family, so if they wanted to strip me away of my medical license, it would be really a harm to all the poor that we take care of in our city through our convent.
Well, Sister Didi, at the end of the book, you and Lisa offer 10 prescriptions, moral prescriptions, if you will, for an ailing nation. I'm going to take a few of these. Holy Mass, of course, Eucharistic adoration, frequent confession, and the Rosary really lead the list. Any other prescriptions that you would share with the audience that you think are crucial at this moment?
Okay. Well, I think, again, with that solid basis of prayer, everything else will follow forward. Making family number one, standing strong, being a faithful husband or a faithful wife. Your family is the most important, so you have to be strong to support them, and don't be afraid to stand strong to support them. And that includes with their education and things like that. To be family first, and everything else will follow.
Well, something you said earlier: truth, standing and speaking the truth, which is harder and harder today, and that commitment to go where it leads you. And those are hard things, particularly when you're under attack, when no one is in your corner. And I love that you exemplified you don't only give lip service to those principles, you live them. Dr. Corazon, I'm going to give you the last word here. Look, when I was doing Mother Angelica's biography, there were things I never imagined there that I discovered. I didn't know she dated anybody in Canton, Ohio. But there were a lot of other controversies with bishops and things that were happening privately. Give me the number one surprise, the biggest surprise that you unearthed as you started to write this book.
I love the way Sister lives her faith, came out of her upper room, which in that case for Sister was her chapel, and permeated culture with beauty, truth, and goodness. So for me, it really, the whole book, her whole life exemplifies not only her threefold calling as a sister soldier and surgeon, but really the way she loves so beautifully. That is the call of this book, to follow Sister from the upper room, from beyond prayer, and to emerge into taking our faith into the public square, to permeate it with beauty, truth, and goodness. Nobody did that as beautifully as she did that.
Sister, I'll give you the last word. Any final messages as we wrap up Advent, move toward Christmas, for the audience? What families should keep in mind?
Well, right now, Jesus, as my brother will say, don't make Jesus a premature infant. So focus on his Advent more. And celebrate his birth on December 25th. But before that, let's focus on the hope that comes with Advent.
Sister Didi, Dr. Corazon, thank you for being here. Sister Soldier Surgeon, The Life and Courage of Sister Deirdre Byrne by Dr. Lisa Marie Corazon is available at bookstores everywhere, including the EWTN catalog. Thank you both for being here, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to join us next week. It's our annual World Over Christmas special. You don't want to miss that. Song from end to end, classics, some new tunes. You'll love it. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.